I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with 25-year creative director and Mad Men co-producer, Josh Weltman, who helped make Don Draper act and sound like a genius, all about his new book, Seducing Strangers and the Art of Persuasion Through Advertising. Josh, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I came across you by way of a post that you had written about your new book, Seducing Strangers, on Medium. And I thought, okay, I kind of want to know how to seduce strangers, maybe not in the way that you do. But what I thought about was so fascinating about it was the fact that it was all based on a lot of the work that you had done around Mad Men. And that just intrigued me even more. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about your story, your journey, your background, and how that has brought you to what you're up to in the world today and the work that you're doing now?
Well, what I'm doing now is sort of promoting a book about advertising and seducing strangers and how to get people to do what you want them to do. Or it's called Seducing Strangers, and I'm going around reading that and talking to people about the book. How I got to that place is a little odd. I was trained as an artist, a painter, sort of in a classical style, and I left art school and started working as a political cartoonist at the LA Weekly, and I was, I think, making $70 a week, and my dad said, you know, if you can put together a visual with a headline, you can probably get a job in an advertising agency and do better. I had never thought about advertising. I'd never heard about advertising. It wasn't something that was stressed as a possible use of your talents at the art school that I went to. I went to Otis Parsons, which at the time was much more theoretical and sort of geared towards a career in fine art The closest I got to practical stuff was like magazine illustration and stuff like that. They had a fashion design department, and they had a interiors department. They had a fine art department, and I really was sort of in between communication design and illustration with, you know, kind of a fine art bent. So I went into an advertising agency, I put together a junior book and some concepts and worked my way into an ad agency. And, you know, I was making a comment about who our listeners are on your site. And I remember thinking after about 6 months working in the agency, you know, in a creative department with all different types of people with different backgrounds, you know, ad agencies at that time, 1986, were places where there wasn't really a career path that led to being an advertising, or there wasn't a academic program that led to being a copywriter or art director. People just kind of ended up there from all sorts of different ways, and I felt so happy and satisfied because I was able to do the work well, and I sort of had a knack for it. And I remember consciously thinking, you know, all through my life, I thought I was just a fuck up. and who knew I was on this career path to being an ad man, you know, because creating ads is sort of the skill set is you kind of have to be loud and like a class clown. You have to sort of be clever and strategic. Yeah, there's all sorts of weird things that go into figuring out the problem that really aren't sort of stressed or taught or encouraged, mm-hmm. you know, in typical educational environments. You know, I mean, I was I'm still, I can't spell anything. You know, when I have to write or tweet or just knock something out on Instagram, I look illiterate. I mean, every other word is misspelled. And you know, that was always a problem in school, but in an ad agency, they stress that copy should sound like people talk, not like people write. You never want to give people the idea that you're sort of talking down to them, mm-hmm. you know, when you're trying to sell them something or trying to write advertising copy. So, you know, people were fine with, you know, my stuff just sounding like how I talked rather than how writing should be. And I discovered I was fine with that. You know, it worked better. It was a whole different way of thinking about language and communication than I had been exposed to in school, you know, so that was anyhow. So I spend 25 years in advertising at advertising agencies, mainly up and down the West Coast, mostly in Los Angeles, but a little bit of time in San Francisco and Seattle. My specialty becomes fast food, cars, and high tech, and which is really sort of what goes on the West Coast in terms of big accounts and things worth working on. Mm-hmm. And 7-8 years ago, a friend, Matt Weiner, had written a pilot about it was a, you know, 1-hour drama about a guy living in the 60s and working as a creative director in a fictional Madison Avenue advertising agency. And we've been friends for, you know, a couple years before he gave me the script. I don't know how many. I know Matt did, you know, exhaustive research about the pilot and about the world of advertising before he wrote the pilot. But I don't know how many people he knew who actually worked in the business. And he found out that that's what I did, and he gave me the pilot to read. And when AMC picked up the show and he needed somebody to help him create advertising within the show in the style that, you know, he's a well-known, well-documented stickler for detail. It's hard to find people around who can draw and create ads in sort of the style of art directors who were schooled in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And because I had that sort of classical art background, and because Matt liked, I think, the approach that I came at creating advertising with, you know, I started consulting on the show and working on Mad Men I didn't work on the pilot, but I've been with the show since season one, and we're the final 7 episodes, the last 7 episodes of season 7 are coming up now. So it's been about 7-8 years. There was a one long year in between seasons, I think 3 or 4, or I can't remember which one, but it's been like 7 or 8 years working basically in a different environment in the world of scripted television and trying to contribute what I have to contribute to the making of the show.
Wow.
Now how that turned into a book. You know, I think about season 3, somebody said, I can't remember who said, but I think the other advertising consultant in the room, a fellow named Bob Levinson, who used to work at BBDO in the late 60s and early 70s, he said, you know, so many people are fascinated by the advertising stuff. You should really think about writing a book. And excuse me, I think it was Bob who got put the bug in my ear. And then I it's a long story. You don't want to go through on the radio, but we ended up with a book, not about the show or the advertising on the show, but Workman Press was very specific that, you know, they wanted a book about principles that people could apply today to what, you know, to what they do. So the book is about sort of the principles and techniques that I've always used to create persuasive messages in advertising. Hmm.
Okay, so there's a lot of really interesting stuff here, and I really want to go back to the beginning of this. You know, and I want to start really, actually, one of my favorite things to do, you've heard me talk about this since you've listened to one of our interviews, I want to go back to before even school and look at some of the early sort of childhood influences that led you into a place of becoming an artist, and then talk about how being trained as a classical painter influenced and shaped all the work that you did leading up to this.
All right, we can do that. I remember the moment pretty vividly when I was in first grade and drawing something at a level sort of beyond what other people in first grade could do, that my teacher, Mrs. Jackson, made me pick up my picture of a turkey and walk to every classroom in the school, and, you know. So you start to do something that gets you attention, you know, when you have talent and you're young or little, and you, you know, you don't know that you're any different than anybody else. But when people start doing things like that and encouraging you, and you know, there are art contests and all sorts of different things all throughout elementary school. And the weirder story, I mean, all those stories that you hear a million times, you know, but the weird story was, I was thinking about this last night because I knew you were going to ask things like this, but in fifth grade, in Mrs. Garfield's class, a woman who was also very encouraging of my talent, we had a docent come in, a woman from the neighborhood, who, you know, volunteered to come in to the school and teach the kids about art. And I remember the subject of the discussion was cubism and Picasso. And she put up a couple Braques and a couple Picassos and modern art. And someone in the class raised their hand and said, why does he paint that way? You know, because it was horribly ugly to, you know, to fifth graders, and shocking, and just sort of, you know, there wasn't anything kind of romantic or pleasant about these paintings. And I remember the woman, I think her name was Mrs. Bennett, said, well, that's how he sees the world. And at that moment, I figured, well, shit, that's it. I'm never going to be an artist, you know, because I see the world normally, you know, I judging from what I'm looking at, you know, it's pretty much the way I see images on TV and all that sort of stuff. I guess I'm not an artist at all. And I really kind of believed that from fifth grade through somewhere in junior high, like eighth or ninth grade, I remember, you know, having an epiphany, just walking through the halls thinking, oh, it was a metaphor. You know, he doesn't really see the world that way through his eyes. He just portrays it that way. But, you know, for like 4 or 5 years, when everybody else in the world is like getting into comics and all that sort of stuff and thinking, oh, I could really probably do this if I concentrate, I thought, well, that's it. You know, I may be talented and can draw really good, but I'm never going to be an artist, you know. So I was derailed in fifth grade by a innocuous, stupid answer to a dumb question. Actually, not a dumb question, but just one of those little things. Hmm. Anyhow, so those were the beginnings. But then towards, I guess, the end, like around seventh or eighth grade, I started taking life drawing classes at a school not very close by. I lived in the North Valley. My parents got me into an art class, where I could study from life from a very young age, you know, and I would take the bus like once a week into Santa Monica and study with a fellow who, named Eddie Butwinick, who was really all about teaching figure drawing the classical way. I just loved it. I mean, that was totally, he could sort of push me and, pull the best out of me at the same time. It was, you know, that finding the right teacher, you know, at the right time, is one of those things that makes such a huge difference. And I was lucky, you know, and I remember, you know, I was thinking about, I guess I was probably 15 years old. I had been taking classes, drawing and painting at Brentwood Art Center for probably 4 or 5 years, you know, once a week. And I was pretty good. But one day we were painting the figure. And I remember the model's name. His name was Mark, and I just got into kind of this groove, doing kind of a Leroy Neiman meets Manet kind of thing, in very bright colors and all, and just really, really quick, and it was the first time, I think, you know, that I really kind of felt the flow that happens when you're pretty good at painting. Mm-hmm. And it was overwhelming. And I threw away the brushes. I couldn't switch brushes fast enough to do what I wanted to do. And I started painting with my fingers, and, this just sort of frenzy happened. And, at the end of the class, I still wasn't finished, and I was obviously really into something. So Eddie let the whole class go home and kept the model for another hour and a half for me, so I could finish this thing. And I kind of worked through it. And at the end, you know, I was totally spent and covered with sweat and literally covered, you know, up to my elbows in paint, because I wasn't using brushes. It was all finger paint. And the thing was extraordinary. And it still hangs, you know, kind of in the entryway of my parents' house. So every time, you know, I drop by, or I drop the kids off, or I walk in and visit my parents, you know, I'm reminded that, you know, for 40 years, I've known what it feels like to be in it, you know, and to sort of be able to work at that level where it feels like it's taken you over, you know, kind of thing, which is really nice. That's the, to me, that's the best feeling, you know, in the world when it comes to creativity, that you kind of fall in and find this thing that you're both discovering and making at the same time.
Wow. Well, that raises a lot of questions for me. So one of the things that you brought up is that early in life, you had this talent recognized. And I think you're lucky and you're rare in that, because I feel that at some point in our lives, we decide that we are not creative, we are not artists, we don't have that kind of skill. And I feel like so many people kind of just, a handful of people slip through the cracks, like you, and have that encouragement. And I guess the question is around talent and uncovering that later in life, if somehow we didn't manage to slip through the cracks, and how we might do it.
Well, you know, it part of it's talent. I think, you know, honestly, I think creativity is kind of a pathological inability to accept the status quo.
Wow, that has to be my favorite thing you've said so far.
Okay, well, move that to the front. Don't make people sit through the other crap. I think it's just an aversion to the way things are. Some people can look at like a blank piece of paper and go on with their day. And then there's, I hate the word creative, but there's people like me who look at a blank piece of paper and it's like, that won't do at all. Here, give me a pencil. I'll fix this right away. Right. You know, and it's not even necessarily that you have anything that you're trying to do. It's doodling. It's you know. But that whole way of thinking that hey, the way things are just won't do is like the other side of the creative coin. You know, you're always itching. And believe me, I've worked in lots of different disciplines where I haven't been nearly as talented as I am as a draftsman. You know, I mean, it took me forever to understand what was happening in the writer's room. It took me forever to understand what was happening in an ad agency, you know, just in terms of businesses and stuff like that. So the talent, certainly when it comes to drawing and painting, in my case, was a big part of it. I come from a family where, you know, my grandfather, people used to tell me stories and I'd see it, but everybody mentions the same thing that, you know, he was one of these guys that after lunch, you know, if there was, you know, wax from the cheese on the table, everybody would be talking and sort of hanging around. My grandmother's clearing the dishes and, 15 minutes later, there's a line of wax circus animals, you know, on the table that my grandfather has sort of pinched and pulled and made out of nothing, you know, kind of thing. And I'm the same way, you know, people saw it in the writer's room. I can't keep my hands, you know, still and to the side. I'm either doodling or making something or, you know, it's just, it's like whistling for musical people, I guess, you know, shit like that. Just always making stuff. But in terms of getting the job done in different places, you know, like agencies, like a writer's room, like, you know, I think that I'm not sure about creativity. I like talent and I like experience, drive, bravery, you know, just being willing to say the thing that everybody else is thinking. That no one will say has solved the problem a number of times in my experience, you know?
Yeah.
And that's sometimes creativity, but I know other people in the room had thought of the same answer and just were not willing to say it out loud, you know? Anyhow.
Let me ask you this. Why do you think we miss those moments early in life? Because I know I had some of them looking back. I can trace them back now while I'm doing this show. But nothing as far as my adult life and the path that was put in front of me would have indicated that I had missed those moments.
Well, miss the moments of feeling creative or feeling that flow? Or
both. I know that I can look back. I can pinpoint them from junior high to, you know, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade. But I could never connect them to a career path. And I'm wondering why I missed those moments and why most people do. I feel a good amount of people do, actually.
That's interesting. Well, I remember being really aware because I think it was kind of in between high school and college. I, you know, late in high school, early in college, I was much more interested in comedy and theater and stuff like that. And I didn't know what the career path was, but my hero was Chuck Barris of The Gong Show. That's where I wanted to go, you know, on television, doing shit that it looked like whoever owned the network had no idea was going on at 3 p.m. kind of stuff. I thought that was just the funniest thing around, and David Letterman picked up that attitude that I thought Chuck Barris had, in the early 80s, which is, let's just get away with this before anybody finds out about it. You know, was kind of the thing that I thought was really funny. I had been into, you know, Mad Magazine and National Lampoon, and I didn't know how you did it, but, you know, I was hanging out at the Comedy Store on Westwood Boulevard and sort of trying to work my way in there. I was a English major and taking a lot of theater classes at UCLA. And then after 2 years of that, kind of realized that in every class I was in, whether it was theater or English or, you know, there were like 80% of the class was better than me. And and this was going to be a really long slog. And I thought, well, you know, every time I take an art class, nobody's better than me. So let's sort of switch to art school and just start pushing this thing downhill. You know, it's going to be a lot easier ride. Mm-hmm. And so I went from UCLA kind of design and theater arts to Otis and into illustration and those sort of things. And I think that being able to say, okay, I like doing this, I'm happy doing this, and I'm really good at it, and I should be going, you know, that's all right, rather than okay, this is hard, I'll figure it out, I'll put my nose to the grindstone, I'll just try. I mean, there sort of it took a long time to realize that what I should be doing for work should be the thing that makes me happy and feel good, you know, not the thing that I can do if I work really hard. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say that. What are the, there's an Italian saying, I don't know how to say it in Italian, but they say, if you're not doing what you love, you're gathering water in a basket, you know, kind of thing. And I didn't know the saying at the time, but that's kind of what I meant when I thought, okay, let's push this ball downhill, mm-hmm. kind of thing, and sort of go where your talent takes you. And I've, since going to art school and since sort of getting out and being on any career path, I was always really aware of basically the bargain that you make as a creative person on any career path, which is, you know, what I wanted from day one was I just wanted every day to be different. Mm-hmm. I didn't care how much money I made. I didn't care. But I, you know, from doing sort of Joe jobs in high school and college and sort of getting my way, making my way, working in restaurants or working in law firms or doing things where I wasn't thinking and I wasn't making stuff and I wasn't able to, I knew I'd go crazy. You know, I just had to just stay around interesting questions and problems that I hadn't seen before. That's the thing that makes me tick, you know? And so I think there's a lot of emphasis in, you know, educational environments. I'm becoming very good at one particular thing, you know, and for people like me who that sounds like hell on earth. Mm-hmm. It's what do you do? You know, how do you, my whole thing is constantly learning how to do the next thing, you know, how to do something else. That's the only thing that, and I've been very, very lucky, you know, and sometimes not so much. I mean, I remember, at one point in my career, I'd made something like 35 Carl's Jr. hamburger ads, you know, it over the course of 6 years. And I thought, you know, I can do the 37th one with my eyes closed. You know, I know how this game works and I know what they want. And if I do this, I'm dead, you know? So I decided I had to go someplace else and try something different and sort of blow up a pretty successful career, mm-hmm. And do something else, or else I would sort of lose the thing that got me to this point, you know, which was always being curious and always being interested in learning how to do something different. If I settled in, it was just a matter of time till sort of the flame went out, I guess. I don't know how else to put it. So I remember, you know, where I was standing, when I said, I'm not going to do any more of these. I'm going to go down the hall and quit. And then discovering like 6 months later that when you decide to, you know, blow up your career, that's really like the last decision you get to make. After that, you're reacting to what the world throws at you. And that's part of what you decided to do, but you don't realize, you know, what sort of control you're giving up when you decide to shake things up, you know. And it put my wife through a lot. It put my kids through a lot. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I think it led me to a series of sort of better assignments in a much better place than I was. But you know, you have to do that every now and then. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no. There's no path, you know, for people who are inclined to make their own, you know, kind of thing.
Wow. So there's just pure gold in this. I mean, you've sparked about a dozen ideas for essays I want to write now on my blog. Okay. You know, I want to talk about something which should surprise nobody listening. You've mentioned education a handful of times. And one of the things that really intrigued me that you said was that this kind of thinking is really not encouraged. In fact, it's almost discouraged. And, you know, school is designed for us to become very, very good at one thing. And I'd be really interested in hearing your thoughts on modern education and how we start to shift it so that this kind of thinking actually becomes the norm rather than, you know, some weirdos like you and I who decide to challenge the status quo and do something that nobody would tell us to do.
Yeah. How do I say it? I think that the idea of trying to, you know, educate a group of kids by age, you know, and sort of sticking them on this conveyor belt and putting them through a system where they're all supposed to learn basically the same things at the same rate, is not doing people a great deal of good, considering that we're not living in a mechanical, machine-oriented, you know, world anymore. You know, we're working with ideas and things all the time. One of the things that I'm a big fan of is whatchamacallit, sort of much more tactical, hands-on, practical learning, because I think that sometimes, at least what I've found, is you have to do things a lot before you can really get good enough to create something new or interesting. You know, I had experience in college, a lot of friends who did not have the foundation of drawing that I had in art school, and they were not only frustrated in art school, you know, because they couldn't draw, they were frustrated throughout their whole lives with without ever having built up the foundation. Like I said, I went in the 80s when things were really conceptual and art was about the idea and not the execution. And a lot of art schools just threw drawing out the window. But, you know, it takes a long, long time actually doing physical things like drawing, carving wood, all the things that they used to have in school when I was growing up, shop classes. I had this feeling about 3 years ago that I had just been staring at glowing rectangles, you know, for the last 15 years. And I was losing the ability to sort of turn three-dimensional objects around in my head. And I could feel that my problem-solving abilities were diminished. So I bought a motorcycle and I pulled it apart and I put it back together. You know, just I had never done anything like that before, you know, but just to start working in a three-dimensional and solving problems in a three-dimensional world again, you know, we don't live in a digital flat tablet world. Mm-hmm. And they're wonderful and there's a lot of great things and I use them all the time and there's problems that I couldn't have solved without computers and things like that. But in terms of thinking, I love seeing different sort of educational systems that involve kind of hands-on practice and discipline and discovery. I think a big part of my education that people don't even consider was I think in second grade, someone at the school, I had a very progressive school principal at the school, elementary school I went to. They started an international cooking club, and the kids would go after school to someone's house in the neighborhood, and a mom would teach them to make, you know, Italian food or English roast beef and Yorkshire pudding or stuff, you know, whatever their sort of cultural specialty was. And my mom was involved with it, and it was just a huge thing. It was tactile, and it was different senses, and it was understanding the world from a different point of view. But it, you know, there was a lot of that sort of United Nation, it's a small world thing going on there, and that you can't imagine. There, how do I say this? There's no app for that, you know, kind of thing. I'm sitting around with a bunch of kids for an afternoon making food, you know. It's huge, you know.
You know, it's really interesting to hear you talk about sort of this non-digital world, especially, you know, as I'm in the process of talking to a publisher about a book deal, you know, based on how much writing I've done and how there are other creative habits, you know. And I was just talking to a friend this morning saying, you know, something I've had this urge to do and I can't figure out how is, you know, those guys who, you know, put on those masks and listen to techno music and paint those really cool paintings on the street. I started looking up those things on YouTube this morning. I thought, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to go to the art supply store, buy some paper and some spray paint and start attempting how to do this. And it's interesting because like I found creative cross-training somehow has influenced all my work in ways that I would have never imagined. And that's really, I when I sent the you know, revised attempt at a table of contents to the publisher, I said, I think I want to start exploring different art forms as a part of this book and part of my research, just because I feel like it leads to so many places. And I think it's such an important thing.
Oh, for sure. That, you know, someone told me, excuse me, more stuff to edit out. after working sort of as a visual art director, creative director, you know, and my whole history with visual arts leading to me getting this job working in the writer's room of the show, someone had given me some really good advice, which was, if you're going to start learning to do something new, at the same time, take a class or go and find some time every week for you to do something that you know how to do well. So I think the first, second season of the show, I would take one night a week and I'd go to a head painting class at a local art school, mm-hmm. you know, just so while during the day I was feeling sort of really off balance, I could remind myself every, you know, once a week that yeah, you know, you do know how to do something. And it's not just reminding yourself, but using a part of your head that knows how to solve the problem while at the same time using a part of your head that's wrestling with new ways of solving problems, I think is, like you said, I think it's a kind of a creative cross-training thing. I think it helps.
Hmm. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a bit and let's start talking about this whole idea of communication design, seducing strangers, and you know, talking about it through the lens of, you know, what happens on something like Mad Men.
Okay. One of the first conversations I remember having with Matt about why, you know, other movies or television shows that had ventured into advertising agencies didn't feel authentic and real to me as an ad man was because they always treated sort of the creative idea for the ad as sort of, what do they call it? Deus et machina, you know, it would fall from the machine, fully cooked in the last, few pages of the show, you know, into the brilliant creative genius's head. And that's just not what I ever experienced in 25 years working in an ad agency. The conversation was something to the effect of, you know, if coming up with a solution or advertising or an ad is a 100-yard march down the field, the ad only happens in like the last 2 or 3 yards. The first part of that march is discussions with the client about their business problem and finding out what it is they want you to do so you can focus your resources at solving the problem, who the competition is. You know, it's a bunch of bad ideas and false starts and red herrings and campaigns that you didn't sell. And then maybe there's meetings and the person that you started with is no longer working on the problem and you have to start all over again. And, you know, famous advertising man David Ogilvy wrote a book and said, you know, I think in 1968 he wrote the book. He said, Confessions of an Ad Man, and he kind of rewrote it in the 80s. But he said the gestation period for an ad campaign in his agency is probably about 3 months. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, it hasn't changed a whole hell of a lot. schedules have changed enormously. They want it in 2 weeks. But the fact of the matter is what you hand them in 2 weeks gets handed back to you or it doesn't work. And eventually, you know, you spend 2 months, 3 months on it because that's how long it takes, you know, to come up with it, to really get into to a business problem and go through the process of what I always thought felt to me more like discovery than creativity, because at the moment that a lot of people I work with describe the same feeling. At the moment, I would discover the reason that a group of people bought a particular type of product or something, the answer to how to motivate them sort of floods into your head in many different sort of ways and message. It doesn't feel like, at least for me, it didn't feel like I was creating all those things. It felt like, you know, if I could look at the problem, look at the market, look at the way people behave, discover what was motivating the prospect at a level that no one had found before. Mm-hmm. Things were just dripping off my pen faster than I could write them down. You know, it felt like, you know, the tumblers fall, you know, and everything just looks, you see things completely different. You envision the market completely different. You know exactly what your client has to do to make it happen. And ideas for ads and headlines and messages are just sort of falling out off your hand, you know. I guess it's creativity, but it's a weird kind of feeling. Anyhow, that sort of how to make that process real, you know, what it really looks like in an ad agency is an advertising art director sitting in the office of an advertising writer, their partner, and, you know, for 7 hours leafing through magazines until one guy says, you know, hey, what about this? And someone else says, well, it would be better if we did that. Okay, let's market that up. Mm-hmm. So it's really not particularly dramatic. What we would try and do on the show is sort of show all the stuff leading up to that kind of moment of discovery, mm-hmm. and insight, and try and use that not to tell business stories. No one was particularly interested in advertising the ad business, but the show is about what's going on emotionally inside of each of these characters, and it happens to take place, you know, or what's going on emotionally is we can see it when it manifests itself in their work, you know, kind of thing.
So let's do this. I want to get into sort of the foundations of communication design and the seduction of strangers, but I want to actually talk about something that, you know, we had started chatting about before you said, Trini, hit record because we're going to miss some good stuff here. I want to talk about the sort of storytelling structure of Mad Men and The Pace, because, you know, we were saying, I was telling you that I had gotten through 8 episodes and every friend I talked to said, Trini, you would love this show, and I couldn't get into it. And everybody said, you got to get through that first season, and then you do. It's super addictive. I'd love for you to talk about sort of that aspect of Mad Men and kind of, you know, how that applies to us as people listening and our own creative process.
Well, it's like the creative process of Mad Men is Matt Weiner's, you know, I mean, what I was involved with in the show was trying to contribute, you know, advertising stories or solutions to problems that he would pose. You know, it was like, how do we show this happening in the agency? What happens when what happens when two people are going after the same job, you know, or what happens when Peggy, the young junior copywriter, sort of hits a room full of people that have never seen a female copywriter, mm-hmm. you know, or what's the best way to show some of these ideas. I guess what I'm trying to say is in an ad agency, you're trying to come up with stories and solutions that lead to a financial payoff. And on the show, I was trying to help a group of writers and Matt Weiner, the showrunner, come up with solutions that led to emotional payoffs. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's kind of a really different thing. You know, it looks similar if we do it right, but what you have to do in messages and communication to make somebody take action, you know, is very different from what you need to do to make them feel something. Mm-hmm. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
I can talk to you about, you know, it's pretty simple. The book lays out, the four, ads that I have used, or not four ads, four kinds of messages that I've used over the course of a 25-year career to motivate people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Let's get into that.
I felt at a certain point, I think after being in it a dozen years and a client I think early on in my career, I had the framework was sort of thus, that the agency was responsible for kind of all the emotional stuff having to do with the brand, you know, making it accessible and making it friendly and making it funny and all those things. And the client was always sort of trying to get you to put more of the facts in, and they, 1 second. They were kind of responsible for all the product features. And I saw this as, and it was sort of set up that way. It was kind of set up as sort of this zero sum game and back and forth between, you know, the agency and the client. We would try to make the ads and stories more emotional and more, more community or more, consumer benefit driven, and they would look out for the story of their product, which they thought was the hero of the story. And at a weird point, or, you know, and at about 12 years into it, I kind of realized, you know, there are only two reasons that human beings communicate, and that's either to evoke emotions or to transfer facts. And I thought it was the job of the agency to evoke emotions, and it was the client's, you know, responsibility as the brand manager to keep an eye on the facts, and that's how we existed together. And one day this client, you know, asked me, he said, is there an agreed upon, is there a right amount of brand to sell in a commercial? And he asked, like, was there the right amount of ratio, like flour to water in a loaf of bread? And and he made those little quote marks with his fingers when he said brand, like, you know, I'm gonna treat it as it's something real, because I have to talk to you agency people, even though I don't really believe in things that I can't see. But it was such a bizarre question. And I didn't know how to answer, but I couldn't get it out of my head, because one of the things that they emphasize in ad agencies is that you should always try and put your head into the mind of the customer, you know, and try and speak in their language and try and understand what they were about. And I thought, you know, when we sort of hit a wall with clients, we always go back to the agency and kind of ridicule them for being, you know, sort of blockheads and not understanding the creative process. Right. Understanding emotions and shit like that. But I really tried to think about what this guy was asking. And after a few months of mulling this around in my head, I had sort of come to the idea that I had only done four different types of messages in my whole career. And those messages were designed either to introduce a new product, bump sales or traffic, make what made a product or service different, unforgettable, sort of the fourth category was create a sense of simpatico with a group of customers, sort of shared values and empathy. And I would call those ads sort of thank you notes or inside jokes, you know, to let them know they were ads about the differences between people rather than the differences between products, you know, because sometimes you find out, like we did on a campaign for Carl's Jr. that I worked on years ago, that you know, all hamburgers were pretty similar. There wasn't a lot of difference between the offerings of a lot of people, but we went after what made this certain group of fast food users different. We went after the 18 to 34 year old guy who was really hungry, who liked a big juicy burger, you know, and at the time, everybody else was going after price, you know, and what we did was we started talking about what made the product different, which was it was big and juicy and dripped all over the place. And then eventually, after we sort of saturated the market with that message about 6 years later and everybody understood that, you know, what made the product different, we started talking about what made the customer different with a different kind of campaign. And that went on for a couple of years. You know, so these, what I talk about in the book, or a good portion of the book, is about to do each of these different things well requires sort of not only different facts and evoking different emotions. For instance, if you want to introduce a product, in my estimation or in my experience, it's kind of counterintuitive, because what you want to do is you want to leave something out of the introduction, because what you really want when you introduce a product is you want people to inquire about it. It's very hard to get somebody to buy something the first time they see it. You know, what you're often trying to do is get them to go to a website or get them to stop in or get them to take a test drive or something like that. But you want to evoke a sense of curiosity, you know, which is very different from what you want to evoke when you're trying to get somebody, when you're trying to bump sales or traffic. What you're trying to evoke in people in those messages is a sense of urgency. And the salient fact in those kind of ads are limited time offers that, you know, if you don't come in now or this weekend, the price or the opportunity will disappear. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes I think that messages fail. People aren't good at using ads and stuff like that, because they're mixing, they're trying to do too much at once, you know? One of the things that I got, you know, from working in the writer's room is Matt or directors or people constantly in the entertainment field are asking, what's the scene about? Because everything in the scene should be pointed to the one thing we're trying to get people to take away from this encounter. And a lot of what I think makes persuading work better is focusing really clearly on what it is you're trying to get people to do, you know, mm-hmm. and getting everything that isn't helping you do that out of there. Is that okay?
Yeah.
That was more about the persuasive messages and stuff you'll find in the book.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I mean, it just, you know, I mean, I can't help but think that in a lot of ways that something like this, you know, kind of, like you said, you know, a creative person doesn't have a path, they make their own. And I always say, yeah, you don't get a map, you get a compass.
Right, yeah.
And that's to me what so much of this sounds like. You know, Josh, this has been just brilliant. There's so many interesting insights and you know, one-liners here. You know, having heard our interviews and given your background and what you do, I'm really interested in how you're going to answer this question. What do you think it is that makes something or somebody unmistakable?
Unmistakable?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what makes someone unmistakable? Okay, hold on. Okay, this is going to be a weird answer, but the best book that I ever read on winning new business when I was at an ad agency was a book called The Rules, about what women should do to go from being single to become married. And rule one was be a creature unlike any other. And I think that that's probably what makes people unmistakable, is that they are willing to be whatever it is that makes them who they are, you know, rather than trying to put on and act like someone else or who they want to be. Sometimes it just takes a while. Mm-hmm. And it's your path or your journey or it's the real answer is probably patience. Mm-hmm. You know, to become something that's unmistakably different and unique. I find that a lot of friends of mine who I talk to, you know, between 45 and 50, discover that, you know, when they were young, when I was young, there was somebody in the field who I looked up to as a mentor. And I thought, you know, I'll just work hard and pay my dues. And when I'm their age, I'm going to do their job, you know, and that's what I want to be. And the weird thing is, by the time you get to their age, the world has changed so much that oftentimes their job doesn't exist anymore, you know, and you have to figure out how to be whatever it is you're going to be with the skills that you've developed in the world as it exists for you now, you know. So I think you're changing plus the environment that you're working in changing makes you unique, you know, mm-hmm. or gets you to a place where you can, you know, be something different. People come up to me all the time and ask me how I got, you know, the best job in advertising, which was being the admin on Mad Men for 7 years. And I got it because I sort of did three things that needed to be done together. I could draw, I could work with the writers, you know, and I had sort of that 1940s education. So that helped. Matt always says that in show business, you know, it's not about your idea as much as about why you need to be attached to it. Mm-hmm. You know, there weren't a lot of people who could do sort of three things at once.
Well, Josh, this has been just absolutely fantastic. One of my favorite conversations I've gotten to have on the show.
And great. Thanks.
I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your insights, and you know, everything that you've learned and been through with our listeners.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I'm sorry about the coughing and the voice and stuff like that. And if you need to... you know, you want me to just re-record anything that I've
No worries, no worries. We're good.
I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah, we're totally good. And for everybody listening, I will link up Josh's book in the show notes. I can't wait to get my hands on it and, you know, start digging through it. And we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.